Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 10, International Fund Issues, the U.K., Japan, and Singapore. Ethan Johnson, Simon Curry, Tamako Fuminaga, and Daniel Young will discuss international fund issues in the UK, Japan, and Singapore. Now, on to the podcast.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm just going to start off this panel session by giving a brief update on a few European matters. The first is recent developments in relation to the EU regulation of market abuse. Secondly, then, a brief look at where things have ended up on the issue of unbundling commissions and payments for research and MiFID II, which is the Revised Markets in Financial Instruments Directive. And then a status update on the extension of the passport under the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive to US managers and other non-European managers. But firstly, in relation to the market abuse regulation, the current European regime for addressing market abuse has been in place for a number of years, since 2005, but it's recently been substantially overhauled and updated, or an updated set of regulations applies from the 3rd of July this year, which is obviously pretty imminent. The regime, as you'll know, seeks to prohibit abusive behaviour in the form of insider dealing, the communication of inside information, and manipulation of markets. In that respect, it covers securities and other financial instruments that are admitted to trading on regulated markets in the EU. And it also regulates the disclosure of inside information by issuers of securities. Two quite important points to note for market participants who are outside Europe is that the regime applies to persons wherever located, if they are acting in relation to EU-traded securities. And secondly, behaviour is caught if it takes place on-market or off-market. So it doesn't matter whether the transaction that's being dealt with is on a venue or not. All that stays the same, but the updated regime does introduce a number of material changes which are worth noting. The first is that, in contrast to the current regime, which is made under a European directive, the updated regime has been made by way of a regulation, and the distinction between the two is that a regulation doesn't require any sort of transposition into national law of member states. It's directly applicable to market participants. That has the benefit, in theory at least, of harmonising matters across member states, but what it does mean is that individual country governments and regulators have much less of a say in providing guidance and interpretation, and that role is left largely to the European Securities and Markets Authority, which can be more of an unpredictable quantity and rather more difficult to engage with than individual country regulators. Certainly, in my experience, more so than regulators like the FCA in the UK, who've historically taken a lead on market abuse issues. Secondly, there are some important extensions to the scope of the regime. At the moment, the existing regime relates to financial instruments which are traded on European regulated markets, but under the new updated regime, that's going to be extended to non-exchange financial trading venues as well, so it will cover multilateral trading facilities and organised trading facilities once these are introduced under MiFID II in January 2018. So effectively all European trading venues will be in scope, so that'll be a substantial extension to the trading activities that can be within the scope of the regime. Secondly, although at the moment it applies to financial instruments, the new regulation will extend that somewhat into certain types of non-financial instruments by including behaviour relating to emission allowances, manipulative behaviour relating to benchmarks, and manipulative behaviour relating to spot commodity contracts, where those have an effect on the price or value of EU-traded securities, as well as the other way around. So it will cover also behaviour in relation to traded financial instruments which have an effect on underlying spot commodity contracts. that expansion of scope to cover all trading venues will make it potentially quite difficult, I think, for buy-side market participants such as hedge funds and other fund managers to identify whether a particular financial instrument is within the scope of the regime. Helpfully, the new regulation requires ESMA to compile a centralised list of traded instruments, but somewhat unhelpfully, that can't be relied upon as being a definitive indication of whether a financial instrument is within scope. So it may have a somewhat limited benefit in terms of compliance. There are some key areas of impact in relation to issuers in terms of the requirement for them to publish inside information as soon as possible. There's a general tightening up around the ability of issuers to delay disclosure. Disclosure can be delayed in certain circumstances, in particular where immediate disclosure would prejudice the legitimate interests of the issuer. But the new rules will provide that any sort of delay in disclosure has to be notified to an issuer's regulator in its country and a written explanation provided for any delay that there's been in disclosing information. More relevant, perhaps, to market participants is that there is a new regime allowing issuers to take market soundings from potential investors in relation to proposed transactions. And that will protect an issuer from an unlawful disclosure of sensitive information where that information is given to potential investors, provided that the requirements of the market soundings arrangements are complied with. But points to note for market participants are who may be on the receiving end of disclosure are that all information disclosed by an issuer in those circumstances has to be recorded along with the identity of the investor to whom it's given and the individuals representing the investor. And all that information is available to a regulator on request. And then, more significantly perhaps, a proposed investor receiving information has to assess for itself whether it's in possession of inside information as a result of the disclosure that's been made to it. And that assessment has to be made on the basis not just of the information that's been disclosed, but all other information that might be in the possession of the participant. And so it won't be possible for investors to rely on the fact that they've indicated to an issuer that they don't want to receive inside information, and nor will it necessarily be able to rely on an assertion by an issuer that information given to it is not inside information. It has to make its own assessment of whether or not that's the case. Additionally, there's a proposal by the European Securities and Markets Authority that investors should keep a record of that assessment and the reasons for it for a period of 5 years. I'm going to move on to take a look at where we are in terms of research payments and commission. This is an aspect of the Markets and Financial Instruments Directive, which is going to come into effect in January 2018. One of the more hotly debated aspects of the directive has been its proposals to unbundle trading commissions and research payments. The European Commission published its final delegated directive on that issue in April, and it essentially endorses the approach which had been recommended by ESMA, which is to effectively ban value-added research as an inducement unless it's paid for either by the investment manager itself from its own resources or via a research payment account which is funded by a specific research charge paid by clients of the investment manager. The operation and running of research payment accounts is subject to some quite burdensome procedures. Additionally, it endorsed the approach recommended by ESMA that research charges must not be linked to the volume or value of transactions which are executed on behalf of clients. And so that originally was taken as the sort of death knell for commission sharing arrangements, given that they were based on joint collection of research and expenditure. However, in the directive that came out in April, the Commission did depart somewhat from ESMA's recommendations by including in the rules a provision which acknowledges that a collection of a research charge may be made alongside and at the same time as a transaction commission, provided that the research charge is separately identifiable. So there's been quite a bit of debate around whether that will keep the door open for commission sharing arrangements, although in that context, it's important to note that there's still an overall requirement to make sure that payments for research are not linked to volume and value of transactions which are undertaken. I'm going to just very quickly mention where we are in terms of the extension of the AIFMD passport. The AIFMD, as I'm sure you're all aware, regulates the marketing and management of funds in Europe. It contemplates that it can be extended to non-European managers. A report was made by ESMA on that subject last year. It wasn't conclusive in relation to the States, but it's been tasked by the Commission of reporting back in relation to the US by the end of June this year, and so there may well be some hopefully positive developments in relation to the possibility of US managers being able to take advantage of the directive in order to passport funds into Europe. Although, if that does come about, it's important to note that there are a number of burdens perhaps which go along with that, not least that the manager would have to be subject to the full scope of authorisation in the directive in the same way as a European manager, which would include submission to capital requirements and operating conditions and controls around remuneration, conflicts, risk management and portfolio management and the like. Separately, it would have to establish a legal representative in the European country in which it gets regulated, and disputes with investors would need to be settled in accordance with European law. And there would also be restrictions around the activities which the manager could carry on, particularly in relation to execution of transactions outside a discretionary mandate, which would be prohibited, and placing activities. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Tomoko.
Thank you very much.
For Japan piece, I pick up two topics for today. The one is the impact of recent amendment of the Article 63 exemption, and then another topic is the recent trend in the shareholders' management dialogue under the Japanese Corporate Governance Code. So let me start explaining about the Japan legal framework in connection with the hedge fund area. In Japan, the fund establishment, fund management, and distribution are all categorized as the financial instrument business. And in order to conduct in the financial instrument business, it is required to be registered as a financial instrument business operator. So that's the principle. So if you conduct into the fund establishment, management, and distribution in Japan, you must be registered as a financial instrument business operator. There is a couple of the way to escape from the business registration requirement. And then one of the most popular ones so far is the Article 63 exemption. This is the exemption for the private placement of the limited partnership fund and manage the LP asset contributed by the Japanese investor. So if you meet a certain requirement, you don't need to be going through the business registration. You just file that simple notification to conduct certain things. And the requirement to be eligible under the Article 63 is you have to have at least one qualified institutional investor. From now, I call it the QII. And then if you have imported a certain transfer restriction, you are eligible to be the Article 63 exemption. And then you can sell that the LP fund product to the QIIs and then up to 49 QIIs in the manner of the private placement and then manage that the fund. Another the solution to escape from the business registration is to meet the minimum requirement. This is the business which is small enough and then not will be give the impact on the Japan market. So this is excluded from the business registration regime. And then in order to meet the requirement, there is a four factor. And then in short, it means that if you have only QII investor and then the total number of the investor is less than 10, and the total asset contributed by Japanese investor is less than one-third of the total asset of the LP asset, you are qualified as a de minimis test, and then you can rely on that exemption. Before March 1st, which is the new rules for the Article 63 exemption is applied, become effective, the Article 63 exemption is so easy, and then the GP can rely on that this exemption and then still can sell directly to the Japanese investor. So Article 63 exemption is more popular. Actually, the Article 63 exemption is broadly used, and then as of the April 30, there's a 2,640 filer exists. And actually, this is larger than the registered financial instrument business operator, which is the less than 2,000. On the other hand, Article 63 is because too easy, so they are broadly used, but also cause a lot of a problem and they are used for kind of like abused way. Especially the Article 65 filer is really targeting the elder people and then kind of victimize them. So the Japan FSA decided to apply the stricter rule, and then thus the new rules became effective on March 1st with the 6 months grace period. And then under the new rule, Article 63 filer become more expected to be behaved as a financial instrument business operator. And then more disclosure, more report, and then subject to the inspection, and then subject to the administrative sanction, and then severe penalty. Also, the some information need to be disclosed to the public. That's probably looks so painful to the fund manager. So this is the comparison between the old rules and the new rules. And then there's a couple of things that are quite new. And then because the Article 63 exemption is abused, so they limited the scope of the non-QII. And then originally, non-QIIs means anyone other than QIIs. But under the new rules, the FSA decided to narrowly tailor the non-QII, including like a listing company, the big company with the big cap heading capital and the net asset, the TMKs, the foreign entities, and then the big corporate pension fund. And the high net individuals, not just regular individuals. And then especially for the foreign fund manager, there is a one requirement to need to appoint a representative in Japan. The previously is not imposed. So the fund manager now seriously thinking about whether they need to maintain their status as a Article 63 exemption because it's easy a notification. They are casually decided to file it, and then it's a benefit to for the GP to directly approach the Japanese investor. But now they are back to review that their business model and then seriously thinking about whether they need to keep it or not. So the fund manager is noticed to the another way to escape from the business registration. So this one is only cover the asset management side. So if you still want to sell in the LP product, you need to hire the local securities company to sell that the product. But if you want to keep that the investment management activity for the Japanese investor, you have to choose to still rely on the Article 63 exemption or meet the de minimis test and then withdraw that the Article 63 notification. And then within the 2 months, we have seen the many big players decided to withdraw the Article 63 exemption. And then compare with the March 31st, like about 50 filers already withdraw. So this trend may be continue until the grace period will be end, meaning is August 31st. So this is about Article 63 update. And then I also want to quickly mention about the recent corporate activity by the fund manager. As a part of the Abenomics, the Japan government recently adopted a stewardship code and the corporate governance code. So under this code, the institutional investors are expected to making a constructive engagement and then purposeful dialogue with the listing company. So under this circumstance, there's several of the fund manager more actively try to talk with the manager and then try to make the business improve. Although the most of the Japanese big company, doesn't much like that idea, and then but still the government push it, so they need to listen anyway. And then if the, you want to make that the kind of a post-border, activity, I want to note the two things. One is related to 5% rules. And then in general, if you have a large portion of the shares, you have to file that the large shareholding report. If you close over the 5%, you need to file. And then that ones need to file within the 5 business days from the change. So this is kind of busy, only 5 business days. But if you were the asset manager and then notified to the regulator, you can enjoy the special rule, and then you pick up the 2 days as a record day. And then you only need to file within the 5 business days, but from the record day. But please note that this special rule is only applicable if you hold less than 10%, and then if you hold the shares without intention to making a proposal. So if you decided to approach the company, this special rule is gone. And then the making a proposal doesn't mean they're making a formal proposal to the shareholders meeting. If you want to have a constructive dialogue with the company, you may give up to the special rule status and then need to move to the general rules. And then the last one is about the time frame of the shareholder proposal. There is several clients just come to talk to us and then try to make a proposal, but there are several cases we have seen that they are too late. So it takes time, and then you have to be prepared maybe than you expected. So it takes time, and then there is the 6 months the holding period to make a shareholder's proposal, and then you have to hold at least 1% voting rights or the 300 voting rights. And then sometimes they grant one voting right for that, like 100 shares or the 1,000 shares. So please be careful about how to evaluate whether you are eligible to make a proposal. And then I also want to note that you have to make a proposal within the 8 weeks before the shareholders meeting. And then you also need to prepare the certain document, like it's take like 1 or 2 weeks. And then you have to have a 6 months the holding period. So if you want to make a proposal in the next June, you have to start after you back from the vacation. So that's finished.
Thank you, Tomoko-sensei. Daniel?
Thank you, Tomoko. Good afternoon to all of you, and I bring greetings from sunny Singapore. The statistics you see on the slide are taken from an industry survey that the Monetary Authority of Singapore, or the MAS as we call it, conduct on an annual basis. These are 2014 numbers. The 2015 numbers have not yet been released. You will see that in 2014, in terms of AUM managed by Singapore-based managers, that grew to $2.4 trillion in Singapore dollar terms, representing a 30% year-on-year growth from $1.8 trillion in 2013. We saw an influx of $408 billion in 2014, of which $108 million went to hedge fund managers. That represented a 21% increase. $93 billion went to private equity managers, $80 billion to REIT managers, and $38 billion to real estate managers. Just as a footnote, real estate managers in Singapore, i.e. managers who purely invest into real estate, they actually enjoy an exemption from having to obtain a fund manager's license. So we've actually seen a proliferation of managers coming to Singapore to take advantage of that exemption. In terms of where the funds managed out of Singapore are deployed, 68% of those funds are invested into the Asia-Pacific region, 13% find their way into Europe, 11% into North America, and 8% rest of the world. Sources of funds, 81% of funds managed out of Singapore are in fact sourced outside of Singapore. If you look at the statistics holistically, if you take a step back, the picture you come up with, it's essentially the fact that Singapore is very much used as a base for asset managers to run their management business in terms of where they invest, in terms of where they source their funding from. It's not Singapore-centric. Before I touch on the contents of this slide, just a brief background to the licensing regime for fund managers in Singapore. There are essentially three types of approvals that a manager can obtain from the MAS. You've got the full license retail, manager who, as his name implies, is able to service both retail as well as non-retail investors. You then have two other categories, both of which allow the managers to only service accredited investors. The second category relates to the licensed AI category, where the manager can service unlimited numbers of accredited and or institutional investors and is also permitted to manage AUM without a cap. The third category is really the registered fund managers category, or what we call the RFMC. Again, the RFMC manager is only permitted to service accredited and or institutional investors, but the numbers are capped at 30. And in terms of AUM, the RFMC manager is also not permitted to manage more than Singapore dollars 250 million. Against that background, an interesting development that has been brewing over the course of the last 2 years is how the regime in relation to accredited investors is being looked at by the MAS. There is currently a differentiation between retail and non-retail investors in the way that the capital markets regime in Singapore protects them. Presently, investors who meet the relevant income or wealth thresholds are automatically classified as accredited investors. For individuals, that's a $2 million net asset threshold and or income of at least Singapore $300,000 in the preceding 12 months. If you're a corporation, you're essentially looking at net asset values of Singapore $10 million and above. In July 2014, the MAS consulted on a proposal to essentially flip the system around so that rather than treat accredited investors by default as accredited investors, in future, once the new regime comes into force, individuals or corporations who satisfy those financial thresholds have to actively opt in to be treated as accredited investors. In other words, if you do not secure an opt-in confirmation from these investors, then as a manager, you're bound to treat them pretty much as retail investors. In terms of process, the consultation paper also dealt with how the opt-in procedure has to be implemented. So fund managers have to provide clear notice of this opt-in right. The notice that goes to the investors has to describe, as well as warn of the disapplication of the regulatory safeguards that they would be waiving or giving up if they decided to opt-in. In relation to managers who are currently servicing existing accredited investors, they will be grandfathered in the sense that you will not need to obtain an opt-in confirmation from them, but they will have the ability to opt out under the new regime. The relevance of the accredited investor definition really touches on a couple of areas. Firstly, we have a safe harbour when it comes to marketing of securities in Singapore that is specifically tied into making the offer only to accredited investors. Secondly, as I mentioned previously, there are two classes of regulatory approvals that a manager can obtain that allow you to service only accredited investors. And thirdly, if the fund that you're marketing to investors is targeted again at only accredited and institutional investors, you avoid the need to go for full recognition or authorization of the fund itself. You can actually get away with a simple notification to the MAS, which is not really an approval process. So some of the industry feedback that the MAS has received include the following. Clearly, managers in the two categories that I mentioned who are only permitted to service AI clients have come back to say, you know, with this new system in place, you're basically allowing an investor to decide whether he wants to opt in or opt out. And, you know, that can represent a loss of business for us because by virtue of a license conditions, we are only permitted to service institutional investors. Well, the MAS has come back to say they will not change the proposal and that it's very much up to the individual managers to demonstrate their value proposition to the investors, essentially to persuade them to opt in as AIs. Secondly, the proposal is also based on the principle that an investor can elect his AI or non-AI status pretty much on a per FI basis. Just to be clear, the proposal here doesn't affect only managers, it affects all financial institutions regulated by the MAS. So that would include banks, insurance companies, finance holding companies and the like. So the proposal contemplates that you as an investor can, for example, opt in as AI with a fund manager, but in relation to your dealer broker or with your bank, you could also elect to be treated as retail. Investors have, under this new proposal, the ability to opt in and opt out at any time. Again, that has caused some concerns from an operational perspective. you know, whether or not the managers have the requisite systems and infrastructure to deal with that sort of process where investors pretty much can decide as and when they want to opt in or opt out. The rationale behind the proposal, essentially, which is investor protection, has nonetheless caused the MAS to say that they will nonetheless give the investor this discretion to opt in or opt out at his own discretion. Secondly, and very quickly, for those of you familiar with Singapore fund structures, we currently have available to us under Singapore law the traditional private limited company, the share model, the limited partnership, which is very much modelled after the UK system, as well as the unit trust under common law. And as most of you will know, with each of these structures, there are varying obstacles or difficulties when you start looking at things like variable capital structures, ease of redemptions, rules applicable to when income can be distributed, and one other point which I didn't mention on the slide, the ability to segregate assets and liabilities, not externally, but internally within the entity. Well, in March of this year, in a speech given by our Senior Minister of Finance, it was announced that the government is looking to implement into Singapore law a new legal structure, the open-ended investment company structure. Details have not been announced yet, but this is really an attempt by the government to add on to the incentives that it has already brought into force in order to attract not just the fund managers to come into Singapore, but also to encourage managers to start using Singapore domicile fund structures for their funds. And clearly, if you're a multi-strategy manager, you know, accustomed to adopting umbrella sub-fund structures, the introduction of the OEIC in Singapore will certainly help you consider setting up a fund under Singapore law.
Daniel, thank you very much. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.